Today we are looking at Dhammapada verses 277 to 279, which read as follows.
Sabbe sankhara anicchati yadapanyaya pasati atanibindati dukhe esamago visuddhiya. Sabbe sankhara dukhati yadapanyaya pasati atanibindati dukhe esamago visuddhiya. Sabbe dhamma anatati yadapanyaya pasati atanibindati dukhe esamago visuddhiya.
Which means, all formations are impermanent. When one sees this with wisdom, then becomes disenchanted in regards to things that are unsatisfying.
This is the path of purification.
All formations are unsatisfying. When one sees this with wisdom, then becomes disenchanted in regards to those things that are unsatisfying.
This is the path of purification.
All dhammas, all realities, are non-self. When one sees this with wisdom, then becomes disenchanted in regards to those things that are unsatisfying. This is the path to purification. So these three verses were taught actually in response to three different stories. But they weren't very different. So the stories are so similar that it's fine to put them all together and talk about them all at once. But more importantly, talking about these three verses all together and the stories as well, talking about them as a whole is important. So putting them together and talking about them all at once is actually more valuable than separating them. We're able to then talk about the bigger picture, which is, of course, the three characteristics. So the stories behind these verses, each one with a different group of monks. So in the time of the Buddha, it seems generally that monks were organized into groups, friends perhaps, or those who had ordained at a similar time, maybe ordained together. And they would receive the teaching of meditation from the Buddha himself or from one of the Buddha's chief disciples, and then head off on their own to practice. Sometimes for a short time, a long time, with the goal to put into practice the teachings that they had learned and see how successful they could be with attaining the goal of the Buddha's teaching, freedom from suffering, enlightenment, and so on. But for this time, of course, they were without a teacher, so it seems to have been hit or miss as to whether the individuals were able to become enlightened. And in these cases, even after putting out effort, the monks in question were not able to attain the goal of the Buddha's teaching. Somehow, whatever meditation they had learned wasn't enough for them. And it's often not the fault of the actual teaching or the meditation instruction. It's just sometimes each individual needs different instruction, specialized instruction, extra instruction. And so they thought to themselves, well, this isn't working. What if we were to go back to the Buddha, receive some more in-depth instruction, specific instruction? We can relate our problems and our practice to the Buddha. And let's see if that will help us, if we learn a new meditation or more detailed meditation or something extra. And so this is how these verses came about. In each of the three cases, the Buddha taught a different verse.
It's quite likely that these verses were taught more than three times by the Buddha. It's certainly the case that these three verses are taught regularly by all Theravada Buddhists throughout the Theravada Buddhist world. These three verses might be, well, are definitely some of the most important verses in the Dhammapada, some of the most important verses in the Buddha's teaching, some of the most powerful verses in the Buddha's teaching. And so going back to the Buddha, what the Buddha saw was that the first group of monks in the past, actually under the Buddha Kassapa, it says, you know, under the tutelage of a previous Buddha, or perhaps not even under the tutelage, but in the time of a previous Buddha, they had heard about impermanence. And impermanence was something that resonated with them. And so they spent a lot of time contemplating impermanence. Now, contemplating impermanence didn't seem to have brought them to enlightenment, but it was still something that resonated well with them and would be a powerful focus for them to apply themselves to and gain better results. And so the Buddha taught them the first verse, that all formations are impermanent and so on. And as a result, it worked because of their upanisaya, their past inclination, the work that they had done in previous lives. In the second group, the Buddha saw that, well, they were very much attuned to the concept of suffering, having in past lives contemplated it. And you might say this is why these monks ended up being ordained together. They had similar inclinations, but it seems that as a group, that these different groups were more inclined communally to a specific characteristic. And so the Buddha taught the second group, sabbe sankhara dukkha, all formations are unsatisfying, suffering. The third group, well, they seem to have been inclined towards non-self, and so the Buddha taught them, sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas, all realities are non-self. And that resonated with them, and likewise they were able to put it into practice or apply themselves in the practice, able to succeed as a result of the Buddha's instruction. So the stories aren't much, but they are instructional. The first thing we learn from the stories is that meditators get stuck. People who apply themselves in the Buddha's teaching can have difficulty progressing. I think it's not quite fair to say that anyone ever gets stuck. To say that someone is stuck requires there to be a person who gets stuck, and that's kind of ridiculous. Of course, this isn't mud that we're walking through, and you can't get stuck in the mud. But many meditators will complain. It is certainly a reality that meditators often feel stuck, feel like they're not making progress, feel like they're treading water rather than swimming ahead, never going to find the far shore, just able to tread water and not get anywhere. But it's not really the case, because our minds are constantly active. If we're not engaged in wholesome activities, then most likely we're engaged in unwholesome activities. It's not usually the case that someone is able to just tread water and not go anywhere. And so every little bit of meditation and application is helping us. As we can see from the stories, these monks who had actually practiced in past lives, they had gained something from it. It was a support for their eventual enlightenment. But what we see from these stories is that there is the case where we can be stymied, and conversely, where we can be supported by instruction. I mean, it reminds us of the importance of having opportunities to meet with the teacher. Obviously, in our center, and even in the time of the Buddha, there were many cases where monks stayed with the Buddha, and as a result were able to get specialized instruction, individualized instruction, and progress more easily. Those monks who went off on their own oftentimes became stuck without having this interaction with the teacher, someone to hold you accountable and to point out the flaws in your practice, point out omissions, point out bad habits, sloppiness, complacency, and so on. Even just having a teacher, having contact with a teacher as a psychological tool, makes you feel more accountable.
because of your needing to report to the teacher, needing to report some sort of progress or some sort of activity at least. So it reminds us of the importance of having a teacher, and really just of the greatness of the Buddha and the potential for us to not succeed as rapidly as we might like or as rapidly as we might be able to. That sometimes we have to be able to consider for ourselves and adjust our practice for ourselves. Sometimes we have to step back from our practice. Take a moment to stop practicing and to ask yourself, why do I feel stuck? Why does it feel like I'm not getting anywhere? Is there something I'm missing? Something I'm omitting? Something I'm lacking in my practice? Or something, conversely, that I'm doing wrong? I'm applying myself in the wrong direction. Maybe trying to control the practice, going against the three characteristics, for example. Why teaching the three characteristics is so helpful and so valuable? This is one of the reasons, is because because so often we're headed in the opposite direction. We're trying to control our practice because our whole inclination is to seek out things that are stable, satisfying, and controllable. The second thing we learn from the stories is this idea of upanisaya, which means the things that we are born with. We're not all born equally. We're not born with a clean slate. This is obviously the case. Anyone who spent any time around Buddhist meditators can quite clearly see that this is true. Some meditators have a real easy time of things. Some meditators have a very difficult time of things. In modern times, it's much more likely for people to have a difficult time. We're not in the best of shape in modern times. We have a lot of disadvantages and a lot of distractions and chaos in modern times. We're very far from the original teachings of the Buddha. And so it can be discouraging when you think that we have very little upanisaya. We have very little fuel in the tank, very little to recommend us to this practice. This practice is sometimes feels like it's beyond us, that we're just a failure, that we're not succeeding, that we're not able to succeed. So it's always a good reminder. It can be discouraging to think that we have no upanisaya and to look at ourselves and say, oh, I'm such a failure and I really don't have what it takes to do this. And who am I? And it's quite clear that I don't have what all these other meditators have. They must have done great things in their past life and I haven't done anything great, clearly. Otherwise, I would be succeeding like they are. But it should be encouraging. It shouldn't be discouraging. It should be encouraging that every little bit of practice pays off, has benefit, and ultimately contributes to our eventual success in the practice, even if not in this life. It can be in future lives. This is what had to happen to all these monks. It's a reminder that even these guys who really, you can be quite impressed how quickly they were able to become enlightened. Yes, they spent time alone, got nowhere, but then all it took was the Buddha pointing them in the right direction, nudging them in the right direction. These guys were so ready. That's all it took for them to become perfectly enlightened, well, completely enlightened. So you can be discouraged and think, wow, these guys were so special. But then look at their backstory. How much time they spent in another Buddha sasana, just like we are now. Some people who come to practice might not be able to attain any special realizations or any attainments in the Buddha's teaching, but they certainly do learn about themselves. Everyone who comes to practice learns something, even if it's that they're very ill-equipped to make quick progress in the practice. But upanisaya is not just something that we look back and ask, what do I have, how good of a person I am, so we can feel good about ourselves. It's the encouragement that we get from every little bit of meditation, every little bit of application in the practice. A reminder that all of the Buddha's disciples, even the greatest of the Buddha's disciples, at one point had to begin on the path, had to apply themselves just as we are applying ourselves on the path. And so we intend to gain real and profound results from the practice in this life. But even if that's not the case, certainly, none of it is in vain. Every little bit of goodness, even the good deeds that we do outside of meditation, charity and keeping precepts and helping others and being kind and practicing samatha meditation, even all these things are contributing to our eventual success. The third thing we learn from the stories is the difference in inclination, that even putting aside various levels of ability, we also notice that, as stated, different practitioners are more likely to resonate with different teachings. And so this can sometimes lead people to doubt about the practice of a certain meditation technique, thinking that maybe this technique is not for me, but I really don't think that's as accurate as it is accurate to say that within the meditation practice or the practice of mindfulness, there are different aspects of it that are more applicable to different meditators. We can see this with the four satipatthana. For some people, kaya nupassana, mindfulness of the body, is going to be more effective. For some people, vedana nupassana, mindfulness of feelings. Many people ignore the feelings when they feel calm or happy, for example. They don't note these, and so they can become quite stuck on those feelings. Some people don't note pain when it arises or are stuck on the pain. But for other people, it's citta nupassana, mindfulness of the mind, so their thoughts, being able to catch the thinking about the past or future, good thoughts, bad thoughts, being mindful of thoughts. And that's more valuable and more effective for them to see the three characteristics. For some people, it's dhamma nupassana, mindfulness of the hindrances, mindfulness of the senses, and so on. Mindfulness of the aspects of reality. For some people, that's their inclination, that's what resonates with them and allows them to find success. And the same goes with, we can see here, with the three characteristics. And this is verified by the texts that talk about the different pathways to enlightenment. Based on these verses and based on the other teachings of the Buddha, we acknowledge that there are three paths to enlightenment, which means at the very moment of enlightenment, there are going to be three types of entrance. Some people enter into enlightenment or enter into the path, enter into fruition through impermanence, others through suffering, others through non-self. So it's not that there are other meditation practices or techniques that you should engage in. It's that within this practice, sometimes one or another is more applicable. And we, as a result, are quite careful to try and teach everything, knowing that for some it's going to resonate, different aspects are going to resonate on different levels. As for the verses themselves, well, there's so much in these verses. I mean, it's just one verse, three different ways. There's only one word that, or two words that change at most. And yet, just in this one teaching, there is so much. And it's so profound and so core that these are the kind of verses that every Buddhist should memorize. And it's obviously something that many Buddhists have memorized and are very familiar with. It's one of the sayings of the Buddha that is most well known in the Theravada world. So let's go through it. Sabbe sankhara, the first part. Sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, sabbe dhamma anatta. So the first thing you'll notice is obviously that the first two verses say sankhara, the third verse says dhamma. This actually doesn't have much significance at all. Theoretically it does. The difference, and the reason for the difference there, is that you have to include Nibbana if you're talking about things that are impermanent, suffering, and non-self. Because Nibbana is not a sankhara. And because it's not a sankhara, it's also not impermanent. It's not unsatisfying or suffering or painful or stressful or anything like that. But it's still non-self. Because the idea of something being self is just a wrong view. Any view or belief you have, this is self, that is self, is just wrong. There's no truth in that. Even just as an idea, it just becomes ridiculous. Anyone who practices meditation can see this. But the truth is, in the practice of mindfulness, we obviously aren't taking Nibbana as an object. So talking about seeing clearly that Nibbana is non-self just doesn't mean much. And so even with Dhamma here, it really is still just referring to Sankhara. It's still just referring to things. But so let's not take too much time. If you want, practically speaking, we're talking about everything. Everything is impermanent, but everything in a fairly special way. Ordinary observation of reality relates to people, places, things, objects, entities. In mindfulness practice, in the practice of the Buddha's teaching, our perspective changes and we're focused on ultimate reality. We're focused on experiences. And it's those things that are governed by the three characteristics. So this is what we mean by sankhara. All sankhara, what does it mean? Everything? Well, it means every aspect of experience. The word sankhara cannot be understood to mean anything that arises. Because people don't arise, things don't arise. These are just ideas in our mind. The idea in the mind arises, or the activity in the mind arises. But that's the point, is there's only the experience. When you talk about a person, it's actually just an idea that is part of the mental process that arises in your mind. That idea arises and ceases. And these are the sankharas. Sankhara means anything that arises, anything that ceases, anything that is conditioned, meaning, or anything that is related to conditioning. So sankharas are caused by causes, and they become causes themselves. So there's this chain of causality. Everything in our experience is related with this cause and effect chain that occurs moment after moment after moment. This is the meaning of the word sankhara. But basically, practically speaking, it just means experiences, or the aspects of experience that constitute ultimate reality. The more important word, obviously, is the last word, impermanence, anicchang, anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is the core of the practice of vipassana. It's what it means to see clearly, as this verse points out. And it appears to be something so important that the Buddha called it the path of purification. So what are these three things? Impermanence. Impermanence is a quality of all arisen phenomena. Why? Because they arise and therefore they're going to cease. More importantly, they arise and cease rapidly, momentarily. In reality, things don't last moment after moment after moment. They arise in one moment and then they cease in the next moment. And the only reason we think of them as arising and lasting is because they arise and cease so quickly. But in truth, our experiences are born and then they die. Born and die. And so we ourselves, as beings, as individuals, can be said to be born and die every moment. Impermanence is the first of the three characteristics. It's the first of the three reasons to not cling to things. Why are these three words so important? Because our ordinary way of approaching reality is to perceive things as stable, satisfying, and controllable, and to seek out and control things or maintain things as stable, satisfying, and controllable. The reason why we cling, the cause of all of our clinging, our craving, our attachment, the cause of all our slavery, being enslaved to bad habits and being slave to addictions and to hatred and anger, slave to ego and pride and so on, boils down to misunderstanding reality in regards to these three things. If we saw impermanent suffering and non-self, well, that would be the way to free ourselves from suffering. So it's not even so much about the three characteristics, it's about their opposites. So the first one, impermanence. Ordinarily, we see things as stable. We expect things to be stable, and we seek out everything and anything that is stable, permanent, lasting, reliable. Because something can only be truly valuable if it lasts, if it provides this stability, if it provides this reassurance, this reliability. You know, how much of our lives depend upon things being reliable, things staying the same? People, our relationships, our family, our parents, our children. We rely, we depend, our happiness depends on this stability. We rely on the stability of our bodies. We rely on the strength and continued malleability, wieldability of the body. We rely on our possessions. We rely on our experiences to be predictable, to be stable. And this is a huge part of the reason why we suffer, because none of these things... Well, the essential building blocks of experience that make up all of these things are chaotic, are unpredictable, are unstable, are unreliable. And this is what you learn from meditation. It's in fact not so much about learning something completely new. We always understood theoretically that things could change at any time. But through the meditation practice, you realize that you've been depending on the opposite. And you're suffering because of your dependency on the opposite. Depending and expecting and hoping sometimes. Sometimes it's just hope. Gambling, you know? Gambling and hoping that you're the lucky one who has everything stay the same, who has everything stay reliable and dependable and so on. And you see how stressful this is. This is the first characteristic. The second characteristic, suffering. Suffering, I mean, that's literally a translation. You can understand it as I've translated as unsatisfying, because that helps understand what is really meant here. Because obviously many experiences, you can't say that any experience is not impermanent. Impermanence is pretty obvious. Through the practice of meditation, you see it quite clearly. But suffering can be very difficult to see in some cases, because pleasure is obviously not stressful, it's not suffering, but it's unsatisfying. And one of the big reasons why it's unsatisfying is because of impermanence. We can't depend on things, but we do depend on them. And because of that dependency, when they change, we suffer. Pleasant feelings are dukkha because they change, because they're unreliable, they're unpredictable. Sometimes they don't arise when you want them to. You want to be happy, not going to be happy. You can't depend upon it. You can't control it. Neutral feelings are stressful because you can't keep them forever, because they require work to maintain. Neutral feelings, just to be calm, just to be at peace, requires a lot of work, even in a worldly sense. How much effort is required just to keep the peace between countries, between societies, between family members, even just to keep the peace in your own mind, how much work is required. People who practice samatha meditation can attest to this, that it's a never-ending battle to keep the mind calm. You can experience great states of calm, but when you stop practicing, you lose it all and have to work just to get it back. Painful feelings are, of course, unsatisfying because they're literally painful. So there's no type of experience that could be truly satisfying because of the governing characteristic of impermanence. The third characteristic is non-self. Now, the first two are easier to understand. If I said that suffering is a little harder to understand, non-self is the hardest to understand. It's not so much that theoretically it's hard to understand, but it's something even more so than suffering that we rely upon to be false. We rely upon the idea of control, ownership, possession. This is me, this is mine, this I am. We rely on our personality. We cultivate and obsess over our personality, trying to be someone, trying to be something, not be something, trying to keep ourselves in control, to control the mind, to control our lives, to control everything. We worry about things going out of our control. We worry about not being able to control. It's the source of great stress and suffering that we try to control everything. So even putting aside theoretically whether there is a self or isn't a self, whether this is self or not self, what we see through the practice of meditation reluctantly often the meditator is reluctant to see this and feels like often there's something wrong with the meditation. Why can't I control it? Why am I not in control of my practice? But reluctantly, grudgingly, step by step, you begin to unavoidably accept the very clear fact that trying to control things causes suffering. Non-self. Our attachment to self is a true cause of suffering. Things are stressful because they are not controllable. And when you try to control them, try to keep them, well, the impermanence ensures that they're not under your control. So these three characteristics, they're not the only characteristics of experience, but they're the important ones for this reason. Because we see the opposite, because we seek the opposite, because we depend and rely upon the opposite. But these are not depressing. They shouldn't be a source for remorse or a source for depression, a source for a feeling of nihilism or negativity. They should be liberating. The three characteristics are actually the most powerful liberating, freeing and valuable, beneficial qualities that we could ever hope to understand and appreciate. Because as a result of seeing them, we could become independent. It's not that we lose anything. We just stop trying to gain things that are not possible to gain. We stop suffering from trying to control, from trying to maintain, from trying to be satisfied by things that could never hope to satisfy us.
So this is the first part.
The second part of the teaching is the teaching of seeing these. So the second part says, yada panyaya pasati, when we see these with wisdom. And this is important. It's important to understand the wording here, because it doesn't mean when you understand these intellectually. Me teaching these things to you intellectually is, well, theoretically valuable. I mean, the Buddha taught these things and it was valuable for his students. But it's not the truth of the path to freedom from suffering. It's not what leads us to purity. It's not what leads us to the goal of the Buddha's teaching. What leads us to the goal of the Buddha's teaching is these two words, seeing with wisdom. So remember, what we're practicing is called vipassana, and why the Buddha called it, use the word passana or seeing, is because, for this very reason, because it's easy, relatively easy to understand these things intellectually. But when you experience them, it's going to always, always, always take you by surprise. The experience of the three characteristics is not the true experience of the three characteristics if it's something you expected, something that's familiar, something where you can say, oh yeah, I knew that, right? Obviously, it's something that you didn't know, something that was not familiar to you. It should always surprise you. It should be something that really makes you uncomfortable and takes you out of your comfort zone. It should be something that makes you question, often makes you question the actual meditation practice. What's wrong with this? This practice is terrible. It's unpredictable, chaotic. It's unpleasant, unsatisfying, and I can't even control my own mind. How can this be the way to freedom from suffering? And that's exactly why it is, because it's changing your understanding of reality, helping you to realize that this is not a product of meditation. This is the nature of reality. Meditation only shows you clearly, lets you see clearly. And so our practice, the practice of the Buddha's teaching from beginning to end, really is this process by which we see again and again, see with wisdom the nature of ordinary experience as impermanent suffering and non-self. But it's very much the act of seeing. It's not something that you go looking for even. It's something that through the practice of meditation appears by itself, appears in front of you. It's like going to the zoo, and if you're looking for tiger stripes, well, you don't go looking for a cage of tiger stripes. You go to the tiger cage and you look at the tiger. And all you have to do is look, and when you see the tiger, you will see the stripes. It's a problem with meditators. Why I harp on this is because it can happen that meditators think that they should spend time looking for the three characteristics. But it's sort of a similar case if you're going looking for tiger stripes. Just go look at the tiger. The practice of mindfulness is the looking. When you look, then you will see. The seeing comes by itself. You don't have to go asking, where are the stripes? And just look at the tiger and you'll see the stripes. So our application and paying attention to the four satipatthana, this is the practice. Not focusing on the three characteristics. When we focus on the four satipatthana, we will see the three characteristics. And when you see the three characteristics, remember this, because it's going to be something uncomfortable. Take you out of your comfort zone. It's not what you're looking for. It's not what you want to see. But it's going to change your perspective and help you realize that what you were looking for, stability, satisfaction, control, was unattainable and was a cause for great stress and suffering as a result of not being attainable. The third part of the teaching, attanibindati dukhe, and then as a result of seeing clearly, one becomes disenchanted by things that are, by dukkha, by the unsatisfying, by suffering. It's a powerful teaching because the Buddha doesn't say one becomes disenchanted with things or sankhara. He just comes out right and says it's all dukkha. You become dissatisfied by suffering, reminding us that the things that we are enchanted with, intoxicated with, excited about, are not satisfying, are not happiness. They're dukkha. when we need things to be a certain way, when we're attached to our experiences being a certain way, worried about our experiences, hope they aren't this way, hope they aren't that way, wanting them to be a certain way, then we suffer as a result. So the practice of the Buddha's teaching, this is what happens when you see the three characteristics: your enchantment, your excitement, your seeking out all of this garbage, all of these objects of our desire that turn out to be completely worthless. It just vanishes. Your enchantment, your excitement just vanishes. You become disenchanted. So an experience, practically speaking, of a meditator is going to be quite tired. A meditator will experience the same cycle of seeking, attaining, and being disappointed again and again until one becomes completely disenchanted and decides to give up. And finally, this is the path of purification, Esamago Visuddhiya. And this is why it is the path of purification, because it teaches us to give up. That the practice of the Buddha's teaching is not about attaining anything, obtaining anything, gaining anything. It's about giving up everything. You want to know the very basis of the Buddha's teaching, the basis of Buddhist theory, you understand that nothing is worth clinging to. Nothing is worth holding on. Everything should be given up. And once you can give up everything, then you're on the path to freedom from suffering. The path of purification, the path of purification that we're practicing from the very moment that we undertake the training on ethics. We start with ethics, move on to concentration, and finally wisdom arises in this order, the purification of the mind. So practically, these are three verses that we should always keep in mind, because they remind us of the key points of the Buddha's teaching, that everything is not worth clinging to. That when we see that, the process of seeing this again and again and again, until it makes us sick and tired of causing our own suffering, sick and tired of this terrible, terrible habit that we have of seeking out things that can't possibly make us even content, let alone happy. Only when we realize this, only when we come to this disenchantment, are we going to finally find ourselves on a true path to true happiness and true peace. Because happiness and peace don't need to depend on this or that experience. If they do, you're always going to be disappointed when you don't have the experiences that you want to have, when the reality is not what you want it to be. So very valuable teachings. And hey, these are the teachings that the Buddha had to teach to those meditators who were stuck. So if you ever find yourself stuck, even just reciting these to yourself can often remind you of things that you may have been missing. Ah, yes, here, look at me fretting and worrying, and all it is me seeing the three characteristics. And when that resonates with you in that way, it can help give you the courage to face and to really understand and to really make use of this very uncomfortable reality, that all of the things that we think are going to satisfy us, none of them is ever going to possibly bring us any iota of contentment or satisfaction or peace or freedom from suffering. So that's the Dhammapada for today. Thank you all for listening.